There's an old Roman maxim, si vas pacem, para bellum. If you love peace, be prepared for war. Now, the logic behind this was an attack was less likely if you look like you were more prepared. However, in present day, it seems not about how much you are prepared, but more importantly, how prepared are your alliances? I'm Skynell Hughes, and on this edition of 360 View, we are going to take a look at why some countries always seem to yearn for battle, and if war has become the most profitable business today. Let's get started. Throughout history, wars have been fought when one country has something the other wants and generally does not have the ability to do trade for it. Now, this can be a natural resource, a power structure, or the land itself. Most of the conflicts could be contained to the region. However, today the world is so interconnected, it's almost impossible to not have a war without international involvement or backlash. Now, the Council on Foreign Relations, a global conflict tracker, currently states in 2023 there are 27 conflicts happening worldwide. Almost all of them have interventions from countries or groups outside of their borders. And most modern conflicts have actually become proxy wars, where at least one side is being used to fight the battle for another. Those countries whose resources of land, people, and economic stability are being used by another, even if declared the winner in the end, they find themselves in a situation often worse than when they began. So why do we even need war in the present day? Almost all viable land has been claimed, and now that technology can allow instant communication, why is war not considered an antiquated option? Well, joining me now to answer this question and others is former Pentagon official and military analyst Michael Maloof. Michael, great to see you. Thanks for joining us. And once again, we're talking about war, not a good subject, especially in the present time. So what is usually the objective of a war? And is the true objective always what is stated to the public?
The true objective to a war is to gain your limited purpose, whatever that might be. But invariably, what happens is that it can escalate out of control. And then you have what we would call a slippery slope, and that then becomes dangerous. You can have the best war plans in the world, but once that first shot is fired, everything changes. And that's what we're seeing today. Certainly, that's what we're seeing with Ukraine. We're seeing this build up and crescendo building right now between Israel and Iran, and with Israel constantly trying to get us engaged in that, and so that we fight their fight, which has historically been their track record, and we're seeing conflicts unrelated to just that, India, China, Taiwan. My projection has been that these are so interrelated, becoming so interrelated and intertwined, that we could. The United States, which is probably the perpetrator of a lot of these wars through its hegemonic ways of going about the world today, we could be engaged in about a four-front war at the same time. And that, to me, is very, very scary.
Well, is it always, though, what is being told to the public, being sold to them, as to what the motivation is, the justification for countries getting involved or even going to war in the first place?
No. The Ukraine thing is a kind of fanaticism by neocons within the Biden administration who want nothing more than to contain, if not overthrow, the government of Russia. And they're using Ukraine for that purpose. And using Ukraine has become the U.S. proxy for that. And that's what we're seeing today. And this is what could blow up into something even larger, and that's of concern.
Well, you mentioned the U.S. could possibly be involved on four different fronts. So what does it take for a country to be ready for war militarily, not just currently, but just overall? What does a country need to have?
Well, I think the peace through strength mantra is fine, as long as you're not going around and pushing your weight around. But we seem to be doing that. No sooner did we jump out of Afghanistan with that debacle that Lloyd Austin was 2 weeks later into the country of Georgia and then Ukraine, telling them to encouraging them to try to join NATO. Well, encouraging other countries to join NATO is contrary to six other agreements that through the years, since 1990, the United States, along with European allies, have had with Russia not to expand NATO. We've expanded NATO seven times, contrary to our understandings, our agreements, our understandings being with three separate presidents. We have gone against everything, which then raises the question, are agreements worth anything anymore? And I'm beginning to think not. And Ukraine was under the illusion that we would, by giving up its nuclear weapons, the United States would protect it with its nuclear umbrella. That didn't happen. So.
But what does a country actually need when you're looking at it? I mean, can any country enter a war? Is there actually things that need to be in place, whether we're talking about tanks and actual bullets that they have in their background, economically? What does it need to be a country to be prepared to enter into a conflict like this?
Well, you've got to have vigilance. You've got to have preparedness.
You have to have the people on board.
You have to.
So
have
how do you get the people on board?
Well, it depends upon the conflict. I'm not convinced, and I know a lot of people are not convinced that Ukraine is worth what we're the expenditure of resources that we're putting up with right now at the expense of a lot of other things of our own country and infrastructure. We're defending a border and halfway around the world, and we don't even defend our own, namely the southern border. Now, this is perplexing a lot of people. So the U.S., you have to have people on board. You have to have your population. There has to be a unity of purpose. And as we saw with the very limited excursions with Iraq, going back to Desert Shield, Desert Storm, we have to have a basis for going in. You got to have a reason for and also a plan to get out. You got to have a goal. And what's the goal here in Ukraine? The Biden administration has not enunciated any goal. We're going to stay in there as long as it takes. What does that mean? I have no clue. And we're supposed to buy that as a basis for a policy direction? I think that's nonsense.
So throughout history, there's been conflicts around the world, obviously. But the United States, the last time that really the people were probably on board to go in war fully was at when the United States was attacked itself, whether you were talking about 9/11, which they used that to help sell the war in Afghanistan, even though it kind of didn't have anything to do with each other. World War II, after, you know, obviously Pearl Harbor getting attacked, that's when the U.S. You're not seeing that in these modern conflicts today, except for you're seeing this major deluge that supposedly we should be engaged in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. Why is that? And is that purposely being done to try to figure out that this does have something to do with the United States?
What you're seeing is something far greater than just a country's dispute with another. You're seeing a competition between an old world order and the led by the United States and the creation and emergence of a new multipolar world order. That's what we're seeing. All of our actions, weaponizing our economy the way we have with sanctions against how many countries? I mean, I've lost count. But by doing that, we have turned even our allies against us to the point now where our actions are driving both Russia and China together at a time when that wasn't our policy. But that's the effect.
Well, it's interesting that you bring up sanctions, because I want to talk about, you know, obviously, is boots on the ground really the most effective way to dominate another country in modern day? We have technology, or we found in recent years, a virus can almost cause instant devastation to a country. And as you mentioned, sanctions are also. So why is there still this call for actual boots on the ground and actual military equipment?
Well, we're actually entering into an age of war by proxy. That's where we're emerging into. And war is obsolete as far as I'm concerned. We should be able to, we enter into agreements, we should learn to stick by them, and we're not. And we that just doesn't apply to the U.S., but I'm talking about other countries. I would say that China, for example, wants to claim access to the entire East and South China Seas as its domain. Well, that's really a stretch. because you have freedom of navigation through those areas, even though they want to declare that as their pond. But in reality, you got other countries in that region like the Philippines, Malaysia, India, and so on, and that have equal rights to harvest minerals, but China wants to abscond with it all. So it's not just us. I mean, it's other countries that are emerging large powers. And I think that you're going to see this anytime a country has that wherewithal to expand and to move into these areas and dominate over another country. And that's why countries enter into alliances. But in reality, they're not going to stick with them, especially in this modern age. So we go into an alliance with South Korea and Japan against China. Are you joking? They're not going to go up against China in any with any reality, because that's their big gorilla in the closet there.
But
the rhetoric
sounds like they are. It feels like everything they're saying is very accusatory against China. China's almost the new villain today.
Well, they can huff and puff.
Or will they blow the house down?
So that's the question.
But then also, I've got to ask you, just from your military experience, how long does it actually take to put together and train an army ready for combat in the field? Is it time-consuming, and how much of an expensive process is it?
Well, it's all the above. It's very expensive, and it's a time, and it's a constant thing. And you've got to have, you can't do it with conscripts. You got to do it with enlisted. You got to pay them well. And you got to have a standing army, and they've got to be trained. But we're so diverted these days with wokeism and what have you, even in our military.
But that's the United States. Are you seeing that in other countries? Is wokeism found its way into the militaries of the other countries in the world?
To a point, they have, yes. The question is the quality of training in these other countries. We're seeing in the war right now with Russia and Ukraine just how well the Russian troops are trained. Now, these are conscripts. And we know conscripts are not the best fighters, I must tell you. And they're not necessarily well trained in any country. We saw that with Saddam. And we just mowed down Saddam's troops with our highly trained and highly mechanized equipment. Back in the, first of all, with Desert Shield, Desert Storm. And then ultimately with shock and awe.
So then when it comes down to it around the globe, when you look at it, what are your top five countries who currently you feel like is most prepared for war?
Top five?
I know, I'm putting you on the spot here.
Well.
We like lists here on the show.
Yeah, well, it's going to be, we can rule out two, namely the United States and Russia.
Which you would think, the way the United States talks, that we're ready to go to war tomorrow.
Well, it depends upon the extent. Okay. And what is your goal?
Could America defend its borders right now with where our military is at?
We can defend our border.
Could we defend somebody else's?
But to go halfway around the world, given all the logistical support and what have you, it's going to be increasingly difficult. Plus, we don't have a wartime production underway, and that's why our current supplies of military gear and ammunition is quickly running out. And meantime, we're about ready to create havoc over with Taiwan. And oh, by the way, we're going to defend Israel.
Okay,
with
so the United
Iran.
States is out. Give me the other countries right now who seem to have.
I would
the best.
Say China is probably better prepared than any.
Okay.
They are, even though they have a limited form of power projection, but they can hold their own. If we were to bring in aircraft carriers, which would be our mode of moving into the Far East, they could easily be knocked out by the types of missiles that the Chinese have that are carrier killers.
Okay, we're gonna have to get the rest of this after the break here, because I want the rest of your four. They'll give you a chance to think about it. How about that one? Stick around with us, because after the break, we're going to continue our conversation with Michael Maloof and not only get the other four countries, but examine why the act of a war can be a real moneymaker for some. We'll be right back.
Go A high quality of life, for my definition, is having the necessary conditions measured in terms of the number of hours available in a week to partake in being. Or I would say, to be conscious of your existence and partake in the transcendence. If you're Orthodox, it means one thing. If you're Buddhist, it means another. If you're a Stoic or a Neoplatonist, it's something else. But without it, you are essentially a mundane person bound to this world.
Okay, we are back with former Pentagon official Michael, military analyst Michael Maloof, discussing which nations are ready for a modern war. And actually, Michael, I'm going to edit my question. It's about, probably easier to ask you which nations are not ready for war.
Yeah, I think China is probably in a limited way. China would be somewhat geared for it. Depends upon the intensity of the warfare. Yeah, you have China, Russia, U.S. with nuclear weapons, and that, of course, would be the end of things. And that's how they would end the war and destroy the world.
But who's not ready? That might be an easier question.
Who's not ready? I would say Europe has emerged as not ready. NATO is probably not ready. They've been relying on the United States. The United States can only fight a limited conflict, and we're screaming and yelling about not only the cost just of Ukraine, but what happens if other things pop. I mean, there have been national strategic analysis of the extent to which the U.S. Can fight a 1-2-3 front war. Right now, none.
Right.
None. We were up to two once upon a time. I know when I was at the Pentagon, it was up to two. Now, today, none.
Okay, so obviously, it's a given that there's a war industrial military complex in the United States.
Yes.
So tell me, who exactly profits off of war?
Well, you're going to have the people who profit off of war are people who propagate it and push it, because that's their golden parachute. We see them in the office all the time, and then they golden parachute into a cushy job in the military industrial complex and for themselves. Ultimately, though, it's going to be the companies, and they're going to, many of them rely on government contracts up more than 90% in most cases. That's how they thrive. But in order to perpetuate that and campaign for them every year to get defense monies, you got to have a conflict somewhere, and we're doing a great job of that. So we're seeing this kind of a continuous push for warfare and argument and confrontations, and it's been going on unstopped, there's such a word, for ever since 9/11.
Right. And you have some of these defense contractors. There's some that exist, obviously, in the United States and the West, but there's some around the world as well.
Oh, yeah.
Which also...
Well, they're all interconnected. You know, BAE, Siemens, they're all interconnected. They all try to come in, but they're all limited or focused in the Western part of the world. And that's where... And you have companies in China and elsewhere that are trying to quickly gain the technologies in order to be up to par. And then once they have that technology base, then they can start going on their own. But they still will always need the Western input for how to improve the technology levels. And that's what we're seeing. Australia, which always seems to be trying to clamor for attention. They're eager to come in on with a new quad for submarine warfare, because they, you know, they think they can do what's necessary to help be a deterrent to China. Well, I mean, with submarines, yeah, you're gonna. It's a very, very serious part of the triad, and it's probably the most secure, and that's the one that Australia now wants to be involved in, along with the United States and UK.
But we talk about, obviously, defense contractors, but you have to do the strong tie to the politicians. I think that's the key one that we forget, are the politicians themselves make money off them. It might not show up in their salaries, but obviously...
Well, we're seeing that all the time now, aren't we?
One of the if it's not pharmaceuticals, it's those military contractors that are causing these politicians to go, when they go into office, might have a couple zeros in their bank account, but when they leave, it's amazing how much they've doubled or tripled
those
zeros.
Look at all of our politicians. They've become multimillionaires after having been in office.
And people forget about that. So let's actually talk about the people, because when you think about it right now, especially in the West, most did not feel the effects of Afghanistan. Most kids today don't, unless they are a part of a military family, did not actually see what it felt like to be a part of a war. What does a country look like, and what do they face following a war if they are on the losing side? I'm going to start with the losing side. What happens after the war, supposedly the contract is signed that it's done?
You're talking about a country like Iraq? Iraq has been stumbling, and it still has U.S. occupation, and because of the insecurities that result and the mistakes that we were involved in administering it once we overthrew Saddam. We basically, by doing that, we basically created a political void that allowed Iranian influence to come on in. And something we did not expect or want, but that's what we're faced with today. So it depends upon the ramifications of your actions. All actions have consequences, and that's what we're seeing today. What we saw 10 years ago, 15 years ago, we're now realizing the consequences. We used to see this all the time in my business with export controls and trying to stop diversions of high technology. We would see them inevitably popping up in the weapons systems of other countries 5 to 10 years later. And just like submarine silencing, we saw that with the then Soviets and then the Chinese can't detect the submarines. It's very difficult because of submarine silencing, and given the technologies that were diverted at the time. So this is the kind of thing that we're trying to We got to keep in mind is that what is going to be the consequence, and these are the kinds of things that need to be gamed when we're making major policy decisions. But we have politicians who are very short sighted. They're there for their own purposes for a short period of time, and they only think in clumps. They don't think long term, unlike let's say another country, China or
right.
Look at the Vietnamese. They were at it. They dealt with the French first, then they dealt with us. There was no timetable. We have to have 4-year timetables. That's
because it goes with our elections.
And look at the consequences.
Well, that's how. Well, we talked about the losers. What about the victors? Are you really a victory in some of these countries? The actual country itself, not the allies, but the country that actually wins. Did it really win?
The last time we saw that was the end of World War II, wasn't it?
Right. History.
I mean, since then, there has been no success. Korea, stalemate, still at war, technically. Vietnam, we lost that.
But Vietnam being a winner for themselves, you go through the country, you know, did they really feel like they won?
It took them years to rebuild.
Right.
And they still come under new influences, particularly from the Chinese. They have their own issues they got to deal with countries in that region. In terms of the Vietnamese, I guess it was a success, but we obliterated their country in the process.
And so how long did it take to build back a country after war? And whose responsibility is that?
Well, it probably will take at least a half century on any major war, as we saw.
A generation almost.
Yeah, as we saw with Europe. And Europe has rebuilt, and it's done a great job. But it's about ready to lose its quality of living again because of going into this Ukrainian madness. And they're now beginning to realize that, but it's probably too late for them to turn it around. So they gotta move on. And by doing that, we're entering into greater areas of uncertainty. And I don't know, and nobody knows what the end game is. Right. Nobody knows.
And with that, thank you, Michael Maloof, for joining us.
Sure.
That was former Pentagon official Michael Maloof. You know, a country being ready for war consistently is very exhaustive and it's very expensive. You obviously need the firepower, manpower, and logistical support for your side. And it's not enough to have the most of all three than your opposition, because you also need to have a greater volume than your opposition's allies. But are all of those involved on one side motivated by the same reason? Well, the easy and obvious answer is no. And the true motivation for countries to provide support either comes in the reward of power or money. And while the countries directly involved feel the consequences, those who offered their support will definitely receive direct or indirect benefits. Being an ally in a war can stimulate or sustain a country's economy by producing the needed supplies like weapons and equipment. A war in another land can offer a distraction from the problems which exist at home and give those in power a place to blame for the current economic hardship they themselves have caused. Or support offered can be more self-serving to help protect their own web of corruption. Whatever the motivation is for war in the modern day, it is rarely the narrative being told to the people to justify an outside country's involvement, with the most devastating factor being the loss of life, being a major deterrence by the ones who wage it. I'm Skynell Hughes, and this has been your 360 View. Thanks for watching.